Welcome back to the show. Another exclusive interview is about to take place. Our guest tonight, Vietnam War veteran turned actor, Troy Evans. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone here, you have seen Troy. You've seen him everywhere. Fear and Loathing, Ace Ventura, Bosch, ER, The Frighteners, you name it. Once again, like anyone in the film industry, when we're doing a fun Q&A, we're just getting down to business on just some inspirational advice and just other fun tall tales that Troy knows how to tell.
Who told you that?
I mean, you bragged about it before.
Yeah. If you're going to start believing what I say, you're in trouble. But so have you got some questions?
I do.
Let's dig in.
So you are a Montana boy.
I am born in Missoula in 1948.
Nice. And so, what was it really overall, the atmosphere of that state often like back then?
Well,
in the 50s.
Wow. you know, in my recollection, optimism, you know, I was, you know, started school in the 50s. And that was, you know, one of the best periods in our country's history for the average Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, in those days, you could get a job, you were going to get paid for it. You could afford a car. You could, and it seemed like the sky was the limit. And but of course. And this still goes on. There's a lot of drinking in Montana in those days. Mm. And and it's like, I don't have to tell you, being in Dallas, it was pretty conservative in the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s when I left. But not like today. You know, we had a very famous senator from Montana, who's, I'll think of his name in a second, but it's escaping me at the moment. But, you know, he's the head of the Senate. He went on to be our ambassador to Japan for many years. And, it was, you know, it was a union state. It was a heavy concentration of miners. You know, my family was originally from Butte, and so that was, and so that was a heavy Democratic state. Of course, all that's reversed now. All that's gone in the other direction. But
right, and you even got to talk about this years ago at back in like '89. You talked about it, your stories growing up at the Pacific Theater Ensemble.
Oh, yeah. Were you there?
I wasn't. I just, my research on you.
Oh, yeah. I actually have this one-man show called Troy Evans Montana Tales,
right,
and Other Badass Business. And I've done it numerous places over the past 40 years. And it morphs. You know, it's not a set piece. It's, you know, whatever stories come to mind on that particular evening. But I'll tell you a little story connected to that. That's I love this kind of thing, the synchronicity of the universe, if you will. My wife and I own four little houses that we rent out in a neighborhood near us called Glass Elk Park. And I was over there about 3 months ago. We had one that was vacant, and I was over there cleaning up and getting ready to put it up for rent. And a young man was walking by, and he's with, by young man, I mean like 30-ish.
Right.
And two women with him, one maybe 25, one 35, three women with him, 25, 35, and then those two girls' mother. And they were just out on a walk in the neighborhood, and started chatting with me, and they asked me about the house. And I said it was, you know, it was going to come up for rent. And they said, well, could we look at it? I said, sure, of course. So they went in there looking around, and the guy says to me, are you Troy Evans? And I said, yeah, I'm Troy Evans. He said, oh, he said, you know, I saw your one man show. And so I assumed he'd seen it where you were talking about over, you know, I've done it several theaters in LA and different, I do it like for fundraisers and stuff. For charities I support, I'll do an evening for them, and they can raise some money that way, you know. I said, where'd you see it? He said, Bozeman. So he's from Bozeman, Montana. He went to school in Bozeman. And like 5 years ago, I went up and did it at the university there. And nice. So here, this guy who's just walking by me on the street in Los Angeles is actually from Montana, and he's from Clancy.
That's awesome.
I'm a lifetime Montanan. Clancy is so small, I had never heard of it. I had no idea where Clancy was. So it's a small world, baby.
And then it just opens you up. It's like, man, how many people kind of know me, but, you know, just out there. And I'm sure you get into it now when you got an even bigger movie role, being recognized on the street. You're like, well... Have you always known about me, or was it just kind of word of mouth, or what?
Yeah, well, you know, now that's changed a lot, because for most of the last 45 years or so, I've been in L.A. If somebody would be in a restaurant and they'd come over and they'd say, the most common thing is, are you that guy? That guy? I said, what guys are, well, I thought, did I see you on TV? Or, but they can't quite place it, you know?
Looking back at your resume, I've seen more of you than I even realized. I was like, it's just so funny. It took within minutes. I'm like, oh, yeah, the deputy, the doctor.
But now they can look it up on their phone. So now when they come to my table in the restaurant, they say, excuse me, Mr. Evans? Yes. Yeah, I want you to know I really enjoyed you on Bosch. You know, well, thank you. Yeah, people are very nice.
Right, you know? You're at basically the fourth stage of your career, and now everyone's going to go back at all these movies they grew up loving, like Demolition Man or Halloween 5, and they're going to say, hey, now I'm going to look out for where you are, where you pop up.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Now, those fans are the most dedicated, those Halloween fans, and I'm not a horror movie guy at all. You know, for instance, Halloween 5, I've never seen that movie, and I never, you know, I have zero desire to watch something horrific, you know. But people who do like it, man, they watch that shit every night, you know.
Right.
So,
and
yeah.
There's other people who probably have seen you more than they realize. They just didn't know your name. You're in the pilot of Twin Peaks, you know.
Right, but if they can remember one thing, man, wasn't he on ER? So they go to IMDb and they look at ER, yeah, and then they go to my name on IMDb, and then they know everything that I did, including, you know, it's funny. I look at IMDb and probably 10 to 15% of those jobs, I have no recollection of ever doing them. You know, one day on some movie 35 years ago.
Right.
You know, it's like if somebody said, yeah, you remember when you went and helped my grandma rake her yard? And, you know, no. When was that? Was it like 35 years ago? Well, no. I don't remember raking your grandma's yard 35 years ago. And I don't remember, you know, being the cop on TV show 171 saying, hold it.
Right.
35 years ago. You know?
35 years ago. And that's just it. I mean, and I was even telling, I forgot who else I was telling. It's like, basically, if you wanted an extra side hustle, you could literally go to any convention.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the amazing thing, to me, amazing. Because I don't view myself as a extremely successful actor, for one thing, and this isn't a complaint. I'm fine.
Yeah.
But I am almost always the lowest paid actor on the whatever the project is. On Bosch, I was making 1 to 5% of what the other actors on the show were making.
Right.
And that's the list I'm on, you know, the actors that don't have to get paid. But if you look at my IMDb and count, like instead of counting ER as a job and then China Beach as a job and Life Goes On as a job, count how many episodes in each one of those.
Right.
I've done over 400 TV episodes. And that means I've averaged 10 episodes a year for the last 40 years. That's damn near impossible.
There's that. And then it doesn't help that the networks will just not make good use of these shows. They'll take forever to come out on DVD. And, you know, kind of like with writers, they end up paying you less residuals just because, you know, it's over 10 years old, you know, so making maybe 5 cents per airing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like on the show I did, Bosch on Amazon, there are actually, when I took the job, they told me there would be, the deal was there would be no residuals. And then I don't know how that changed, but I've gotten some modest residuals on that. But going forward, there won't be any. You know, they don't, you know, the only thing Amazon is interested in is selling Amazon Prime.
They haven't figured out streaming and giving everyone residuals per airing, which stinks because it's like, well, what exactly do you make? Especially if you can fast forward through the airing, do you get a quarter of that residuals? You know, is they haven't figured it out, and they probably
all they care about is that in order to see that show, you have to buy Amazon Prime.
Right.
And beyond that, people say, when are they putting out a DVD? They'll never put Bosch on a DVD because the amount of money is insignificant to them compared to whatever Amazon Prime is now, 150 a year or something, from 5 million Bosch fans. That's a pretty substantial little cash cow every year. You know, once you sign up for Amazon Prime, you're paying that every year, every year, every year. I think, you know, I try to avoid it. I don't subscribe to hardly any of those things. But I think a lot of people are like 10 different streaming services, and they're paying like $1,000 a month to watch their TV machine, you know? Crap.
Mm-hmm. Some people are getting wise. I've had some critic pals of mine who basically, they sign up for a month, binge there, and then, you know, unsubscribe until next year, you know, when the new stuff drops. And that's the other thing. I mean, I think if people are wising up and realizing, okay, since we are, it's just like, okay, you don't have to watch it all now. And since it is still coming out once a week, you know, you might as well binge it all in one night and be happy. And do you find it interesting, though, too, that you're getting a lot of fans who vary in age? It seems like for a while there's a lot of material which you just got, like the younger adults, they'll definitely have seen you in The Frighteners and, you know, Ace Ventura, and the older crowd would have definitely seen, you know, China Beach. You know, with this, I'm seeing all kinds of demographics, you know, young adults, older adults, and, you know, your generation, that they've read the books of Bosch, and so they wanted to see it adapted, and vice versa, just people who saw the show and then were like, I'm gonna check these books out. And you'll find this funny, I had read a bunch of Michael Connelly. He was kind of like John Grisham, just knew how to tightly pace his material and pan it out, and I didn't realize I'd read so much of Bosch without realizing, oh, that's right, oh, I did read City of Bones, oh, well, that's what they're adapting for season one, basically.
yeah.
And I'm with you. It is kind of annoying how there is a lot of unfair pay. Like I read one article where it's like, it used to be you're either a movie actor or a TV actor, and, you know, character actors, you know, it can go wherever, but the lead actors, you know, they have to choose one or the other. And same thing with filmmakers, that filmmakers can do good in TV, but especially if the producers give them more creative control, but most of the time they don't. And that's why they preferred film, because often they were running, calling the shots, unless they got studio notes. And I saw one article, which was just outrageous, where there's like, basically like how all these lead movie stars who were making comebacks and all these giant scaled TV shows of late, and they're just being paid out the wazoo. Like Kevin Costner makes $30 million an episode of Yellowstone.
It makes $30 million per episode.
Yeah. So you know how that is. Yeah. Everyone else is getting paid jack diddle. Like maybe 400 for the day, you know, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, you know, I had an epiphany about 30 years ago. I was having the same discussion with my wife, and she said to me, she said, "Well, you know, Troy, you're right. You are getting fucked. But if you're going to get fucked, this is the way to do it."
Right.
I'm not in a salt mine in the Ukraine, you know.
Oh God. Yeah, that is true. And more or less, yeah, it's just like, you're enjoying the ride, you're getting by, but it is annoying how it's just like, you can work all kinds of jobs and be reliable in every day, and yet promotions, you know, any company will skip out on it regardless of whether the workplace is positive or toxic. So it is kind of annoying how we're still at that stance here this many years later.
Yeah. So, I hope I don't sound like a complete freaking ingrate. I've had a pretty good life, and we got a.
Well, everyone has that.
Really, really happy here in LA. yeah. For especially when you consider, you know, when I came to LA, that was late 70s. I was 29 years old. I was a recovering alcoholic Vietnam veteran. I was an ex-convict. And I was 15 years late to start an acting. You know, if you want to be in the movie business, you start when you're 15, not when you're 29. You know? And it's worked out. So...
1,000%. And who was your first agent?
Oh, Dick Lovell.
Dick Lovell, okay.
A fantastic guy. He,
who did he rep for?
Very, very unique. Dick Lovell's specialty was character actors. And he loved the theater, and that's how I got the agent. You know, if you have nothing else going in LA, you, in those days at least, you would work in the little 99-seat theaters. You know, under the Actors Equity contract, a theater, if it can work in a theater for free if it has less than 100 seats. So all these little theaters, and the reason actors want to do that is because then somebody like Dick Lovell can see you and sign you to his agency.
Right.
So, but the thing about Dick Lovell is Dick Lovell had no interest in negotiating contracts ever. His business was providing character actors to TV shows and at scale. And it's actually under the union contract, it's scale plus 10, because when you're hired at scale, then the company has to pay the 10% commission to the agent. So everybody who ever worked in Dick Lovell's office worked for scale all the time. There are some funny stories about it. My friend Will Ute, who was also there, set up a meeting with Dick, and we really went through all this, you know, had it figured out how to nail it. Dick says, "Well, Will, what's on your mind?" Will says, "Dick, the thing I would like you to understand is that I would like to be successful enough in this business that I make you a millionaire. And Dick said, Will, I don't need the money. Where do you go from there?
Yeah. How are you supposed to respond?
Oh yeah. And there are so many Dick Lowell stories. Once I had, and then those were the days of Love Boat. And I came in one day, and that's, you know, I mean, I was not in a league. I did not get offered guest starring roles. However, I came in the office one day. He said, last week, the Love Boat called and they wanted to hire you for a guest star on the Love Boat.
Nice.
But I turned them down because you have that missing front tooth. I said, Dick, I don't have a missing front tooth. He said, oh, I must have been thinking of somebody else.
Wow.
Oh, God. When I finally left him after several years, went in, set up a meeting, told him I was going somewhere else. And he said, why? Why are you leaving me? I said, Dick, I want to do big parts on TV and do parts in the movies. And Dick said, well, why didn't you say so? What did you think I was here for? You know? Oh, God, he was a pill. Yeah. Those were the days. A whole slew of actors.
Is his agency still around?
Well-known character actors now are at Dick level. MC Gainey, do you know who MC is?
Yeah, cool guy.
Yeah, MC and I were both with Dick Lovell.
Did he pass away or is he still around?
MC?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's around.
Okay. I'm trying to think of someone else who was like in Con Air or something or Justified. And
no, it was MC who was in Con Air.
Yeah.
He was the pilot in Con Air. Yeah.
All right.
Well, and he had a nice part on Lost. And mm-hmm. He and I, it was really sweet. We had the sixth season of Bosch. We had a wonderful arc, two or three show arc. My character Beryl and him as a retired cop.
That's right. I forgot about that. I saw him when he popped up. I was so distracted by all the other guest stars.
Yeah. And then he had the heart attack and how sweet that was for, you know, we rented this trashy house in the valley together in like 79 or something like that, you know, and then jump ahead to 40 years and we're doing this wonderful scene together on Bosch. It was pretty sweet.
Totally. And did you feel kind of right at home? Because, you know, seeing how just about all of the cast was just longtime character actors.
On Bosch?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a very comfortable show to work on.
You don't have to be worried about, oh, I've heard stories about this guy. He expects this kind of perfection.
Oh, no. There was, that was a workmanlike set. It was a very good set to work on.
And forgive me if you've already answered this. When you got cast, did you meet with Eric Obermeyer, the showrunner, or just regular casting people, or Michael Connelly, the book creator?
Well, I met Eric Obermeyer in 1976 in a little tiny theater in Santa Maria, California.
Damn.
And which was the first acting job that I got in California. And, you know, you don't go to Santa Maria to climb the ladder in Hollywood. You know, that's not, that's, you know, it's a broccoli growing town with a little theater in it. And, but this guy, Eric Overmeyer, who was, had a couple of college friends who were also working at theater, and he was a playwright at the time, and he came through, so we met then. And then jump ahead to like 10 years ago, 11 years ago, he lives in New York, but he's out from New York, called me, and he said, you know, I'm working on this show with Michael Connelly, and there might be something there for you. So that's pretty sweet, isn't it?
Oh, 1,000%. And then just like old times, he's like, I don't have to work to impress my boss. He thought of me.
Yeah. 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 You don't want to embarrass him.
Oh, totally. But I know what you mean. It's just like, yeah. I'm going to let it take its course and, you know.
Right. So, yeah. So that's been a happy time.
Oh, well, perfection. And so let's even just backing up a bit. What were your main methods when you got into every kind of character? You know, obviously, you know, everyone's got every kind of tell. You take a bit of your persona versus your interpretation versus character backstory that you incorporate. What is your formula that you think just has made you just, again, you know, stand out?
Well, first of all, I like something George Bernard Shaw said over 100 years ago. And he said, anything worth doing can be done best, light and easy and steady and certain. And I just take that, I try to bring a workmanlike focus to the role. And I also believe this, that essentially every human being has the potential to do damn near anything. You know, if the situation's right, God knows what we'll do. You know, so I've always avoided that thing of, well, I don't think Harry would do this, you know? Well,
right.
Why the fuck not? So then, to the extent I think about it, I look at what I think are the primary traits of the character, and I try to amplify those traits in my character that align with that. And the traits in my character, in my personal character, that don't align with that, I tamp them down.
Right, because those are what you relate to, so that's what you invoke the most humanity in.
And that's, and then I this is certainly not an original thought with me, but listen, that's the main job,
right?
Listen, pay attention, and if you just listen to the scene, especially a show like Bosch that's so beautifully written,
the dialogue really does crackle. You know?
Yeah, it's hard. It's pretty hard to go wrong if you're and I'll tell you an actor to watch, and that's you know Jamie Hector, who is Bosch's partner on Bosch.
Been a fan since The Wire. Yep.
And that young gentleman is a spectacular actor because he listens on a level beyond any other human I've ever known. And he does it in real life and he does it in the scene. And you talk to him when he focuses on you, it's like a magnet, it's like a laser.
Nice.
You know, and
that's just part of his persona. He's a magnet.
It brings you into the scene. And so and something, this is my own phrase, but it's pretty evident. The way to be interesting is to be interested.
Right?
You know, if you're focused, like just what we're talking about, like Jamie Hector, he's so fascinating because when you look at him, he really wants to know what's going on. He's listening to Harry. He's listening to me.
He acts so well.
The other guy in the scene, and you think, well, that must be important.
You know? Yeah, his eyes especially are always genuine. Like,
he's a lovely person, but he's a great actor.
Totally. And all you characters that all of you guys are playing have more in common than you even like to admit. You know, like Bosch was kind of in the doghouse, and now Hector's, you know, character is also in the doghouse in terms of family life and detective life eating him up. And you and Gregory Scott Cummins, you know, playing Crate and Barrel, had to essentially, I've seen all kinds of fans kind of do kind of parallels, how you're the Laurel and Hardy, you're the Finn and Munch from SVU, you're the Flynn and Provenza from The Closer. You guys evoke a lot of this very original duo who have some intriguing subplots where is like, and that any kind of person can relate to, whether it's the youngins or the, you know, the elders who are just like, well, I'm just too proud to have to, you know, hang it up. You know, I got nothing else to do if I retire. And if I retire, you know, who's going to look out for me? You know, I'm going to miss the kind of friendship and bonding.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, just in that, talking about Bosch, one of the things I really liked about the writing, and I think this was intentional, but it may have been coincidental, that I feel like Harry Bosch is obsessed with his work.
1,000%. That's why he's fascinating. Yeah.
And Crate and Barrel are the flip side of that coin. We're good at our work. We do our work, but we also have lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a distinction. To me, Crate and Barrel are an available lesson to Harry Bosch if he would take it.
Right. And you guys do have legit dialogue. You are not just there to fill in, you know, filler information. You're legit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of started that way. It started
right. In fact, every show does.
When it started, I didn't expect more than two or three episodes ever, you know. So the amount that we got, and I don't know what it was, but 55 or something like that, that's pretty good.
Right? And yeah. I mean, every show starts that way. You look at, you know, early Twilight Zones, Rod Sterling is, you know, as much as he loves his writing, he's still reading off the teleprompter a little too quickly. You know, you look at any sci-fi show like Star Trek, you know, they're already struggling to make what, you know, the techno bobble sound genuine. So it's going to happen, you know, with any show, good or bad. And how many of these other actors had you kind of already seen and, you know, recognized their face and liked their work prior to collaborating with them, aside from MC?
Oh, I guess probably most of them. However, you do have the weird thing where I don't really watch television. So
you live it. So
so sometimes, you know, there may be some. Oh, in fact, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I did a movie about an ape that plays baseball.
Oh, where was that? And, Ed?
What?
It was Ed, I think, right?
Yes. Yes. And what's the actor's name who was the lead on that?
LeBlanc from Friends.
Yeah, LeBlanc. And I had my usual, you know, small part. When they were leaving to go to baseball camp, I was like the bus driver, you know?
Yep.
And so Matt LeBlanc was there, and I'm chatting him up and ask him how it's going. And it's like the third year of Friends, you know. And I'm like, so how's it going? He says, well, I'm pretty good. I guess I'm on Friends. And I said, really, what's that? I didn't know what Friends was.
What look did he give you?
I think he thought I was an odd individual. And I won't argue that with him, you know?
That's great. Oh, God. Yeah. Well, and you got so many other just lovely actors, too, though, that, you know, much like with you, I mean, you know, I'd seen Gregory Scott Cummins again in just multiple things.
Oh, you know what? The amazing thing about Greg is how evil he could play.
Right?
Oh, my God.
He just constantly was playing the rapist or the biker, and it's just like, of the week, yeah. If it wasn't a low-budget, you know, exploitation movie or a movie where he's playing a terrorist who gets stabbed by the lead, and it's like you just never knew what to expect from him. And I actually got him mixed up with this similar guy, David Shark Frelick, who I would see in all kinds of made-for-TV direct-to-video movies. I'm sure he told you plenty of stories, and you had to see how many stories.
You know, he was in the NFL.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. And he's a natural athlete, you know, and that's I always had a little personal chuckle going about that, because there's all that aura on the set that Titus as Harry is such a macho dude, you know.
Right.
And I'm yeah.
Well, yeah. You'll find this funny.
Get in with Gregory Scott, and you may find out. You may learn something.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Much like you, I mean, he's like at the fifth stage of his career. And what's so funny is there's still people who will constantly on the street stop him. They're like, hey, you're Luther, you know, Charlie Day's dad on Always Sunny. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Old people who watch that show there.
And it was another one. I'm like, I know I had seen him. I would have thought I would have recognized him. It just, for whatever reason, the mustache threw me off.
Funny.
Let's talk about Amy Aquino, who plays your boss, Lieutenant Billets. You know, is another one. He's been in everything. Working Girl, Captain the Winter Soldier, you know, just Crossing Jordan.
It's like, yeah. I mean, she's certainly a good actress, and her, you know, her resume speaks for itself. We're sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum on how you do it. Because okay. She kind of works herself into a lather before a three-line scene, you know? So that's not how I work.
All good. And, I mean, it's going to happen. Everyone's going to find their own.
Yeah, she's got her own thing, and I've got my own thing, so.
It's better than when it gets to, because you would hear all the time, I was actually going to bring me to my next one, I would hear all the time about various actors who would get roles that they didn't want to be in, but, you know, that's what Hollywood wanted to see him in. You know, she's done all kinds of comedy, from Everyone Loves Raymond to, you know, guest spots on shows like, you know, The Practice, and I'd always would recognize her and everything. I'm like, oh, who is that gal? I know I've seen her in all these other intense movies, but and you hear horror stories all the time about just various people who we know and love, and how they would always, you know, they'd work with another person of their caliber, and it was great seeing them work on screen, and then you'd hear the horror stories afterwards, like they were always trying to upstage each other, so it kind of became an unpleasant work environment to where they had to take a day off and just get everyone to just say, hey, let's just take a break from each other, let's just chill, you know.
Yeah. We didn't have any of that on Wash.
Oh, no, I'm not accusing you of any of that. But why do you think that does become a thing, even when people reel back their egos?
Oh, because, you know, I mean, acting is a career that's pretty attractive to narcissists, you know, and for that. If you happen to have talent, enough talent that you have a big career, and you still have a personality disorder, you know, I mean, the stuff that's been coming out about Will Smith,
yeah,
is just horrifying the way he's treated actors over the years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he bragged about it, about how he had special powers that he could see a person's weakness and drive a stake right into their heart.
That's Scientology for you.
Who would want to do that?
A Scientologist.
Yeah.
He said he went to the same church as Travolta and Tom Cruise, so that's a different story.
somebody recently put me on a mailing list, and I get postcards every week inviting me to the Celebrity Center, the Scientology Celebrity Center. And they say they'll help me get an agent.
I hate that.
Ooh, really?
And ooh. It's everywhere, though. I have had to tell so many of my friends who were going to a scamming, modeling and acting agency with no contacts, and they went anyway. I'm like, well, then why did you ask my opinion if you said it? If you wanted to know if they were legit or not? I'm like, I'm telling you, no one has had any good career out of them.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I got to deal with that as well.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Do you get any actual fan mail regarding people who are familiar with your work?
Oh, yeah. I don't get a ton, but I get a few letters every week.
People still send postcards on occasion. They actually legit realize how much more it means now that we're in a post-digital age.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I'm with you. It does get a little disgusting how some film crew members are used to seeing misbehavior but don't report it. Some of it is they're afraid they'll be fired because they did the right thing for whatever reason. And other times it's just, I don't know, they're just used to the toxicity and they're just staying in their lane. But it is annoying how it can take years, and sometimes it's blown out of proportion. But many times it's just like, wow, I don't know how anyone got any shit done. How the editor had to go through so many different takes, have to hear unpleasant stuff. Yeah, I don't know. It's eye-opening to know that there are people who need to be reminded about double standards. It's like, just because just like any workplace, if someone's doing the wrong thing, call them out on it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to do sometimes if you're, you know, a little further down the ladder, but, and I'm not going to get into it now because it sounds like trashing people, but there've been two or three times in the last 40 years that I've just gotten to the point where I stepped up to people who are big stars and said, no,
right?
No, not with me. Right. Sorry. And, you know, let the chips fall where they may, but then, you know, I don't get paid enough to eat shit.
Right.
So.
It sucks how we have to sometimes remind people. It's like, hey, we're all here to do a job. You know, let's behave. And do you think you know, from your time in the service, do you think it just reminded you about a bunch of just, again, standards and just made you become more brave?
Well, yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, that I have a huge wagon load of baggage from Vietnam, you know. As a matter of fact, I had a dear friend from Vietnam die today.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known. I would have done this on a different day where you had moments.
Oh, no. No, it's... That doesn't matter, but
all right.
But and you know, I'm one of those people. I really wish we would stop doing war. Period. You know, we did the Vietnam War, which it turns out both the Democratic president who dumped us in there in huge numbers, Lyndon Johnson, and then Richard Nixon, who promised to get us out and then didn't, that they knew perfectly well that we could, it was an unwinnable situation. It was just, it was posturing for votes in both cases, you know, with yes. other people's lives, including, and I, you know, I mean, what's horrible, we lost 58,000 and change, in Vietnam, but we killed 2 million people in Southeast Asia for yeah. nothing. For nothing.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, what we did in Vietnam was every bit as hideous as what's going on in the Ukraine right now. It was just horrible what we did. And wow. so I have a lot of guilt and shame and regret about that. But the other side of that is, I was in the infantry. I was 25th Infantry Division, and I was there 17 months. And in the 17 months I was there, I think the 25th lost 4,800.
I would not doubt it.
So
people were getting blown out of the sky. So yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, when I'm on a set and Steven Seagal is holding himself up as this big, freaking tough guy hero, you know, yeah. and starts insulting me, I don't have to take that. Yeah. And I had that exact experience. He started ad-libbing in a scene and calling me a pussy and a and I this is the only time I've ever done such a thing in my life, where I stuck my hand over the front of the lens and called cut, which, you know, actors do not call cut.
Right.
And the director of the camera said, "What the hell's going on?" I said, "I'll tell you what's going on. All of this crap that Steven does for make-believe, I've done 100 times for real. And I won't have him call me a pussy in his movie or out of his fucking movie." you know? And Steven Seagal said, oh, why didn't you tell me? I would have given you a bigger part. Well, fuck you.
Yeah, I've had many pals who have worked with them, and I know plenty of all the other horse stories.
You notice we haven't heard much from him lately.
Oh, because he's funding all this stuff, and now he's at Vladimir Putin's castle crashing. So.
He's gone now. Jesus.
It is wild, though, how, like you say, there's a lot of people who like to bring office politics without even realizing they're doing it. And then there's others like him who just think they can get away with it. It's like, hey, I'm an actor. I can say whatever I want. Like, no, you can't just stuff around and expect it to, you know, be okay. You know, not everyone has their shields up. You ambush them like that, literally verbally. That's a fist fight waiting to happen. But on your earlier point, as much as I hate just how politics have become even more toxic in the latest years, I do like how every once in a while there is a cool progressive blog that shines through and other people are reminded of atrocities of the past and saying, remember that, you know, and people who helped earn your freedom and all that. And every once in a while, I will at least once a year just see some big giant blog talking about, again, how all the wars have been for some other second agenda. Like World War II was on power plants and, you know, German cars, you know. And I think a lot of that has been reflected in the latest, you know, international policies and mishaps. So I think it's just very telling that eventually people do get their head out of their ass and, you know, come out from, you know, under a rock and just realize, hey, I'm looking at this all the right way, wrong way. You know, this is, and, you know, with all the war movies I saw, I never once thought I should totally enlist. You know, I didn't buy into any of the, you know, propaganda ads or, you know, enlistment that they would sometimes sneak into some of those movies. Like, it's entertainment. I want no part of any bloodshed. You know, it's not as easy as being Schwarzenegger and jumping from a plane, you know, and that's
right. How old are you?
I'm in my 30s, but yeah, I knew early on, you know, I am not fucking Clint Eastwood and John Wayne, and even they aren't the ones that they play on screen. You know, it's
John Wayne is the biggest phony of the entire 20th century. You know, John Ford, who served heroically in the South Pacific, and he's the guy who made John Wayne, and you know, Ford and Jimmy Stewart and
all these beloved 40s and 50s actors.
And other big stars all serving in combat, you know, and John Ford, there's a letter John Ford sent to John Wayne, said, you know, you got to enlist. And John Wayne responded, you know, I really do want to, this is a quote, get involved in this thing, but I just want to do a few more pictures first.
Oh, shut up. Yeah. You know, and
then he spent, you know, the next 40, 50 years painting himself as a super patriot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a phony piece of shit John Wayne was.
I see it a lot. I mean, you're talking about other people stepping out of their lane. I do see a lot. Why do you think it is that some people just feel like they even have to randomly associate with a cause when they don't have any relation to it? And, you know, no one's buying their BS. Like, you see people, I mean, it's one thing to say very positive things, like, I support this cause, but then you see other people, like you say, I've seen plenty of people do the whole, I'm hanging out with veterans. I'm like, but you're not a veteran, you know? You should just welcome them back and not treat them any differently than you would anyone else with respect, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just amazing, though, how, like you say, I still occasionally will see people just look at someone like they got PTSD, and it's like, man, that you are part of the problem. That insensitivity that you are just, your body language is showing and it's echoing, and it's not welcome in any circle.
Right.
Just as bad as if I say something crazy and you look at me like I'm an alien. It's like, you should instead say, I'm really not making sense of what you're saying. Can you please re-explain what you're saying instead of, you know, reject. And I think that's, I've noticed there's a lot of mental health podcasts out there that I think have opened up a lot of people during post-COVID that just made them realize, hey, if you're lacking empathy, start now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
No fair being a jerk and then expecting a pat on the back in return, you know?
Oh, God, yeah. I just thought of a t-shirt we could sell. We shouldn't, but yeah. I don't give a fuck about your empathy. Well, maybe you should.
Right. There you go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People walking around wearing t-shirts. We don't give a shit about your feelings.
I have seen a lot of those, and it's like, nice mouth.
Okay, so you're an asshole, and you're proud of it. Good.
You're proud of it, and be sure to unfriend me.
Duly noted. Duly noted.
Oh, that's another good one too. Every once in a while you'll see someone, they'll ask for an opinion and they'll say duly noted. I'm like, you do realize what duly noted means. This isn't bad at just flipping me the bird or saying I'm not going to consider it. And I think this is it. I think so many people are just so fancy. They see some famous football star or somebody using the slogan and they got to use it. And it's like, well, don't say it unless you know what it means.
Right, right.
I don't speak douche talk. Oh, man. So do you have any other projects on the side for now, other than
I had one I did a little thing about 3 weeks ago. It was I got a lovely letter from a guy who's a senior up at Cal Arts up in Valencia. And in film, and he sent me a copy of his script and asked if I would do his senior project. And it was a lovely script about guy about my age and his family figuring out that he had Alzheimer's.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so I just, the letter was so nice, and I thought the script was so well written, so I did it. It's a 15-page script, and we shot it in 2 days, a Saturday and a Sunday. And I had such a lovely time. It's called Just One Beer. And so I don't know. I suspect in about a year it'll be out in some festivals and stuff. But it was a very happy experience for me because these kids were so sharp and so good. And I just thought everything about it was great. So I'm
that's the kind of film you want to do, is the one where you're like, I do justice to this part and it's an important story, as opposed to, you know, a random shoot 'em up or
absolutely. Say one of my favorite little side hobbies is listening to the jargon on sets. I love the different craft members, their jargon.
And apple crate. I need an apple crate for the camera shot.
Yeah, I heard one on this I had never heard before. And these are all students, you know, but the guy who was the DP and his assistant, and they were setting up a shot, and they were talking about the frame of it. Mm-hmm. And the assistant said, "What are you wearing?" And the DP said, "A 50.
Oh my God. I've never seen the mascot that way. That's wild.
Isn't that fantastic? What are you wearing?
That's great. I'm so used to sound, speed, you know.
What are you wearing? I'm wearing a 50. Oh,
wearing a 50. Jeez,
isn't that sweet?
That is. And like you say, when you're just watching any crew members on any kind of production, it's so intriguing seeing which ones have been doing it, whatever that way. It's their own jargon. They might as well copyright that jargon if there was a way to copyright it. And there's others who is like, they're just doing what many of the greats have done for years, and they just picked it up off film school or commentary tracks and how-tos.
Now, you know the one that's real old, but still you still hear this once in a while on a set. And this is my favorite. It's mean as hell. But It's legitimate movie jargon. If the director of photography asks the dolly grip for a Mickey Rooney, what's he referring to?
Wow. Is it the nice Mickey Rooney or the ugly Mickey Rooney? If it's off color, it's got to be the ugly Mickey Rooney.
What he's asking for is just a little creep.
Oh, wow.
With the camera dolly, just a little creep. Oh, apparently Mickey Rooney pissed somebody off.
You didn't know that? I know he did it came to fruition in the post-internet age. There was a lot of articles that would forward the most disturbing commentary tracks, and he was on one of them. Basically, yeah. Just foul-mouthed, and it's for like a kid's movie that he was in years ago or something. side of the curtain.
Yeah, his reputation was not too good.
No. And it's amazing. People keep hiring you and then find out the hard way. Oof. Your name means something, but...
They're just... it's like all this stuff about Bruce Willis. The last few years, people knew they were hiring a guy who couldn't do the job. They didn't. It was to them. It was the same as paying Bruce Willis $2 million to put his picture on their box of toothpaste. They didn't care about the performance. They didn't care about anything. They just wanted his name on the movie so they could sell it.
Yeah. Do you think some agents need to guard their talent way more, even if they're ailing?
Oh, no, I suspect that Bruce Willis and his agents and his family probably wanted to get what they could while they could get it.
Mm.
You know, and you could delude yourself into thinking that you were actually doing him a favor. Well, he could still do this much. He can still work a couple of days.
This is the ugly side of business. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a late producer who did a lot of terrible productions, but I knew years ago she told me how she worked on a Dallas set with Faye Dunaway. And, you know, barely could feed anyone. Most of the budget's going to her. And poor PA almost got the whole food tray dumped on her outside her trailer. And I think it's so true. I think there are just so many investors who will just gladly look the other way and just let the film crew suffer misbehavior. And it's just a shame because it's like, well, do you think investing is just ever going to die down at least a bit to where people can just market the formulas, the gimmicks, the premise versus who's in it?
No. I don't. I think it's going to go the other way. I think it's, with all the stuff that's out there.
Investors are irrefusable, and
you have to have a name of some kind.
You know? Bummer.
So well, it's all right.
I mean. It's good to have some names, obviously, but it's just also frustrating because, like, half the time you'll watch a movie and it's like, well, that was good, but, and I love that actor, but they were wrong for that part, or they looked like they didn't want to be there, you know, they had to do it out of contract or whatever.
Right.
And it's a shame. And I get it. It's going to happen. There's going to be a role where it's like, yep, I got to do this role, you know, and I kind of didn't want to, but it just, you have any other kind of, I mean, you've already quoted some greats and noted some other big experiences as well. And I would love to check out that project. It's a short film.
The one I was just talking about?
Yes, sir. Sorry.
Yeah. And they're not even done with the post on it yet, but I think it'll be called Just One Beer. Who knows? It'll probably be on the festival circuit in another few months. Hopefully, I think if they gets it out there, I think he'll do well with it because it seemed to be really, really good.
Totally. Have you thought of doing any theater on the side?
No, I'm, I'm too lazy. I'm too old and tired and lazy to do theater. I think what I'm going to do, somebody approached me, and I have quite a compendium of my stories, agent stories and movie stories and prison stories and Vietnam stories and just Montana stories and bar owner stories. I own
bar fights. Bar.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've been in some good ones. And, and just, start recording those one at a time and then put them together in an audiobook.
Oh, nice.
Because I'm too lazy to actually write them.
Hey.
And that's such a different thing. You know, if I write it down, then I don't have the benefit of my voice, of the pause, of the, you know, of the, you know, that's how I'm used to expressing myself. So that seemed like a really good idea to me. So I think I'll be doing that.
I mean, you might ask a favor from Connolly's people and just ask if you can do the narration too.
Yeah. Oh, the narration on the book?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll do the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Right.
I'll do everything on it. Yeah.
You will already got a loyal fan base. I just know they will definitely buy the Kindle or physical copy on Amazon.
Oh, cool. I appreciate the encouragement.
Well, that's what we got to do. How often do you just see someone just say an idea? And I mean, it's almost as bad as doing improv the wrong way. Improv's pretty simple. Don't negate. And people who can't do, you know, improv are often just saying, no, I'm more of a, you know, this kind of person. It's like, so you just broke the simplest first rule, you know, don't negate. Well, yes, I am a crazy alien who's got 5 heads, you know, or something, whatever the scenario, that's what it is. Let's go with it. And that's how improv works. And
yeah, no, I'm a potato.
You said I'm a tomato. I say I'm a fucking potato. And yeah, Troy wants to do a book. Fuck yeah. Do a book, Troy.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for a moment of your time. And again, keep kicking ass out there.
Okay. I thank you very much. If I get my book done, I'll reach out to you and we can do another one of these and
try absolutely.
To lean on you to sell some books.
Hell, if you're teaching just an acting seminar just locally, let's talk about it.
Oh, in Dallas?
Or just anywhere.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll let you know. And you know, if you come to LA for any reason, you have my contact info. Just reach out. We'll have a cup of coffee.
You bet.
All right.
When the dust settles, I can travel from San Francisco and meet you over there.
Fabulous. Hey, thank you so much. I really Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the inspiration.
Hope you have a beautiful evening.
I aim to. And what is it here?
Are you?
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a